Are you opening this particular episode, or would that be on me?
Oh, well, I think you got it last time, didn't you?
Go on then.
All I've got is, well.
That's how we open the episodes.
Episode two.
Welcome to the episode.
It's a strong episode.
Yep. It's a doozy.
It's a doozy.
And in true impatient podcast style, it's not what we thought would be episode two.
It's not. It's actually episode three, maybe four, but yep. No, it's two.
But now it's two. So welcome to two.
Welcome to two.
But before we go there with our patient, I wonder if you have your own impatient week to share with us, Sean.
Funnily enough, I do.
Oh, that's good. It's because that's the format.
And once again, we are nailing it. Okay, so to tell this story, it's a very short story. I'm going to get it under 2 minutes. Start the clock.
All right.
Bit of context. I work in the emergency services. Mm-hmm. I have what's probably best described as a mental health injury. Mm-hmm. So I haven't been at work for some time.
Yep.
I have a group of friends that I play video games with, mm-hmm. Which was a godsend mm-hmm. during COVID mm-hmm. Because it became like a social event. This week, one of the guys was asking me if I'm still at home, mm-hmm. if I'm back to work yet. And I was like, no, still at home. Mm-hmm. Knowing in my mind that for me means like, just trying to get through a day without breaking down in tears, right? Like that's where I'm
at. Yeah.
And he said, still at home. Wow. That's the dream.
Oh.
Rest assured it's not. Mm. And I didn't quite know what to say to him. Mm-hmm. So I just said, yeah. But that's probably about as bad as my week got, so I probably shouldn't complain too much.
Yeah. But
it does point to perhaps a lack of understanding of, you know.
The impact of words.
Yes. Mm. But then I got a phone call mm-hmm. and it was from you.
Oh.
And you said, mm-hmm. good news.
Oh, great. Good news call.
Which I don't know if anyone out there has friends or loved ones with a cancer diagnosis. Mm. But when you get a phone call, it's a good news call.
Yep.
We like those ones.
And I try to preface the calls because sometimes I don't do a great job.
That's because for the longest time you didn't. And I'm sitting here like, can we cut to the chase? Like, where
what's
are we at?
On?
What's going on?
Sorry. I'm a communications expert, by the way.
Good news call.
Yep.
That rib pain I've been experiencing?
Yes.
Not cancer. So go on.
Segue. First, thank you for sharing your story. And it was a good news call because I had a scan, because I had pain in my chest that was getting progressively worse to the point that I couldn't roll onto my left side. And of course, we haven't gone into a lot of detail on the podcast, but those who are following me will know that this is a sort of a long journey I've faced. And at the moment we're dealing with a new metastatic problem, which is a spread of cancer in my chest wall. So we knew that this is an issue that, you know, we're treating with chemo. And so if I was suddenly having a lot of pain in my chest, then, you know, to me, to everyone else, that felt like a really big risk of, well, the chemo isn't working and the cancer's progressing in the chest and that's why you've got pain. Mm.
But historically has been, right? Has been the case.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally. But, you know, we've done scans and I have been responding to treatment. And so, you know, like, yeah, like, you know, we're good, but maybe we weren't because suddenly I was in a lot of pain. So I trotted off down to have my urgent scan and got results back very quickly because my medical team are a bunch of dead set legends. The phone call with my oncologist was actually quite amusing because he said to me, have you been doing anything that caused you to fall over or have you experienced any kind of blunt trauma to your chest?
Do you now play rugby and we're not aware of it?
I'm not aware of it. And I'm no. You have a fractured rib. And not only do you have a fractured rib, but you have a pneumothorax, so you've actually got a collapsed lung. So basically a bunch of air has escaped your lung. The force of doing so has cracked a rib. And oh, I wonder what might have caused that to happen. We didn't have to wonder for long because, of course, it's the now infamous lung function test.
So eager.
Yep.
To pass the test, you
yes.
were.
Yes, I was.
So hard you worked.
So hard I worked in that test.
You fractured a rib.
Yeah.
And your lung tried to escape your body.
Yeah, that's right. Just
and so I can't stop laughing at this.
It's all right. I laughed at you having a bad week over there too, so whatever.
And so you phoned me with the good news.
The good news.
That you've got a fractured rib and a bunch of lung.
Yeah, it was great news. It was great news. But for those playing at home, this, of course, does mean that I have passed my lung function test and can proceed to the next treatment, which will be radiation. So it was a great week.
Great week. Hey, not that I don't love your story.
Yep.
Should we chat to a patient?
We should. We should chat to Susanna. Susanna, thank you so much for joining us on the Inpatient Podcast. Can you tell us how you became a patient?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. So I'm Susanna. I'm 28 years old and I am a physiotherapist for the NDIS. So I have had chronic anemia over the last 3 or 4 years. So my gastroenterologist recommended a follow-up colonoscopy to see if I had any bleeding or reasons for not absorbing the iron. We had a family history of a few things, so they just wanted to check. And then after that colonoscopy, they just found a small polyp at my appendiceal orifice, which is just the part on the opposite side of your appendix. So because it was in a bit of a tricky spot, they couldn't remove it at the time. So she referred, my gastroenterologist referred me on to a more specialized gastroenterologist at the same practice who specialized in polyps in bad places, really. So they did the biopsy and they found that it was a specific type of polyp, a sessile serrated polyp. So it needed to be removed quickly because they have the tendency to turn into cancer in a short amount of time. And he said within the next 1 to 2 years. So I felt really lucky, super lucky I found it, and it was a bit of an accident, really. So that specialist then had a chat with me, and he said, look, I don't really do these sort of procedures. I've never done one before, but I can send you to a guy in Sydney who does them all the time. We can do them endoscopically now, so minimally invasive, and he's the guy. And I thought, excellent, that sounds really good. So I went up to Sydney for that procedure and they said it was going to be a day procedure or just require the one night stay. On the operation day, once I got there, I was having a chat to the anaesthetist asking questions like, will I have pain? Will I expect to bleed? Like, what's the recovery like? Because of COVID, I didn't get to have that face-to-face appointment with that Sydney specialist. Mm-hmm. So I had a lot of unanswered questions because it was just a bit rushed. So on the day, I got to ask the question to the anaesthetist, but once I got wheeled into theatre, the next thing I remember was waking up after the surgery. So I was really upset I missed that window to actually meet the guy face-to-face who was doing the op and ask questions. So I wake up, next minute, all awake, vomiting everywhere, having some pain, which I thought might be normal, but I didn't know. Because I didn't get cut externally, it was all just internal. I seriously had no idea what to expect pain-wise. Mm-hmm. I also had no idea about, like, toileting expectations or, like, should I be bleeding from there when I go to the bathroom? I seriously had no idea what to expect. So I tried to get a hold of the nurses and I got put on a gyno ward. So they specialized in like hysterectomies or women with birth complications and all these other things. So the nurse I spoke to, she said, sorry, darling, like we don't know what you've had done and we don't know about gastro stuff at all. So then I thought, that's okay. Can you grab me the doctor? My doctor should be around. He was the head of the clinic at that hospital I was at. And she said, yep, sure, we'll try to get someone. And no one came. The nurses later told me that they were communicating via the phone. So if I had queries, they were ringing the team, but I, again, never had any face-to-face contact from any form of doctor or anyone in the gastro team to ask the questions.
Did you get the sense when the nurses are having a phone conversation with the doctor, like maybe just pass the phone over so you could have a conversation with the doctor?
Yeah, like, I mean, when I was in there, I didn't even think of that, but that would have been really great. I would have loved to just talk to them personally so I could relay, like, my worries and they could tell me exactly what was happening rather than sort of having a messenger and telling me.
Yeah.
I was really isolated. I felt away from the people who I needed to be able to access for questions. Even just for like 2 seconds, like, should I have pain? Like, should I be toileting? Like, what if there's blood? Is that normal? Can I eat? Why can't I eat?
Yeah.
But then I got discharged and I got discharged on a round of antibiotics. They lasted about 10 days. I didn't know why I was on antibiotics. I didn't know if that was protocol. I didn't know if it was because they were worried about infection or something, or because I had pain, if it related to that. I seriously just, again, not sure why, but I couldn't even access my surgeon pre or post-op. So, I certainly didn't have a chance once I got discharged either.
Yep.
And plus I was interstate, so I went back home to Canberra from Sydney. The second I got off the antibiotics, I'd actually just gone back to work that day and I saw a couple of clients in the morning. And I remember getting home for lunch and I just crashed on the lounge. So I couldn't get up. I felt like 1,000 kilos. My heart rate went to like over 130 beats per minute at rest. My temperature went to over 39. I was really dizzy, felt like I was going to throw up. And one thing over the phone consultation that the first surgeon did say, gastroenterologist, I should say, he wasn't a surgeon, which was a bit of an issue, but the gastroenterologist said about 10% of people who get this surgery with the polyp in that area go on to develop appendicitis. So I thought, oh shit, like I'm that 10%, great. So I knew to go to hospital. So I presented to the emergency department at the Canberra Hospital. The first thing they did was CT, bloods, stool samples. So after the CT, I'm going to call him Bob, but that's not his name. Bob was the treating doctor on ED that day. And he, and I quote, like, that is the weirdest CT I have ever seen. And he said something like, it looks like your bowel has like a mass in it. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what? I was like, oh, well, I just had it, you know, had surgery. Like the first doctor said, like, there would be a clip to bridge the gap from where they cut the polyp. To put sort of the two ends of the bowel back together. Mm-hmm. And he goes, oh no, like there's not a clip. There's like heaps of staples everywhere. And he said I had the appendicitis as well. So he said I'd need to be operated on immediately because the staples looked like they were blocking the opening to the appendix.
Right.
So he said, well, you're at a risk of the appendix bursting, which means you'd get a large infection. So he was really keen to get it going. But at the time, I was, again, still expecting at worst an appendectomy to just remove the appendix via the laparoscopic procedure, like three little keyholes.
Yep.
And then he sort of sat me down, pulled the curtain with my husband there, and he was like, look, he's like, you might need that, but he's like, looking at the state of your CT scan, he's like, you're going to need a much bigger surgery. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, what do you mean? And he's like, well, because the bowel tissue's just been cut into, it's inflamed and it looks damaged as well due to the staples moving and there's a big mass of something we won't know till we get in there. Right. And he said, so he's like, my the senior guys above me will tell you that it's just going to be a basic surgery. He's like, but I think you're going to need a laparotomy guided by the keyhole surgery as well. So I think you're going to end up having four cuts. But the surgery could even be larger than that because if your first surgery has caused more extensive damage than we think, we can't operate on inflamed tissue because if we cut through it or we try to staple that back together, you're at a higher risk of a bowel perforation. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden I've gone from, oh, I'm just an unlucky 10% to what? Like yep. This wasn't even in the worst case scenario discussed by anyone ever.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I just was, like, me and my husband went, like, straight into shock. Like, I was crying. And my bloods had come back by that stage too with the inflammatory markers, and my stool sampling had come back. This is where things get really messy for me. I came back with C. diff, which was like a form of colitis,
yeah.
But it acts like gastro. So it's like super contagious. And I was chucked in a negative pressure room, isolated, like away from everyone. And then once that happened, like all of a sudden the care just went way down. No one checked in, no one updated me, like the nurses didn't come, the doctors didn't come. And then I was told I'd be like at that night I could get surgery, or I'm first thing on the operation list the next day.
Yep.
So comes around to the morning, still no word, which was a big deal because I was thinking of going private. So at this stage in emergency, I was public, but if I could have chosen the surgeon, I had that option because I have private health. So I actually contacted a private colorectal surgeon to do the operation. And he said, look, if you're in emergency and they're going to do the surgery now, do it. Like, you can't wait. It has to be done. Like, whoever's on shift, like, don't worry, just get the surgery done. Because if your appendix bursts, like, that's a much bigger problem than, you know, waiting till the end of the day for me.
Yeah.
But I waited till the end of the day anyway in public. Mm-hmm. And really, if I had a little bit more communication or any communication in the morning, I could have switched to private, which who knows what that would have done different. But the general surge team came around, or they would have come around at 11 o'clock when I thought I was going in, because they just did some screening and some questions and asked if I was allergic to anything and all of that. So they were involved at about 11 o'clock that second day I'd been in hospital. Mm. And the surgeon who was doing it was a young girl. She, I don't know the rankings of the doctors, but she was only had been doing surgeries for a little bit. And she said, don't worry about it. I've done heaps of appendectomies. Like, it's a simple procedure. Like, there's nothing to worry about. And the senior who was overlooking her who was going to be the operating doctor, the senior said, yeah, like, you got nothing to worry about. Please don't worry about Bob. Like, Bob's an idiot. Like, we have lots of problems with Bob. He tells patients too much info. Like, Bob's crap. Like, they literally started, like, attacking Bob.
Right.
And whilst I wasn't impressed with Bob giving me blunt, hard truth all at once, I actually really respect that he told me, like, from a medical point of view, their train of thought. And, you know, Bob ended up being 100% correct. So all these other doctors who I had way less interaction with than Mr. Bob, you know, they were telling me exactly how it is. And I thought, you haven't even asked me how I'm feeling, what's going on. I haven't chatted to you about the first procedure. Maybe, sure, they did a handover with Bob. I don't know their communication, but from my interaction, like, they knew nothing about me and they were telling me, nah, like, don't worry, what are you talking about? Like, then I switched my mind frame back to, oh, cool, like, Bob's wrong. Like,
yep.
The senior guy said, it's only going to be an appendectomy, like, sweet. So I went into theatre and they prepped me, whatever, and then I remember waking up and, oh, my God, I thought I knew what feeling sick was like, but, oh, my God, it was the worst, like, the most painful, traumatic. Like, I remember I was trying to, like, escape my body. My fever didn't improve. My heart rate didn't improve. Like, it was still really high. I was still, like, really, like, something's not right. So that's the stage I started begging for water. So I was nil by mouth again for the whole 3 days. And they had put me on 63 mils of water per hour just via a drip. And I woke up as well, like, with an NG tube, which I wasn't expecting.
Yep. And so that's a tube that kind of goes into your stomach to feed you?
Yeah. It goes up through my nose and, like, through the back of your throat to go into my stomach. For me, it wasn't for feed. It was for draining my stomach contents.
Okay.
So every 20 minutes they were sucking my stomach contents out of my nose, basically.
Yep, beautiful.
Which I later found out that was to stop that fluid from passing through my bowels, because again, they were worried my gut was in, like, a sensitive state from having two surgeries in 10 days. They were worried about perforation.
So but you didn't get any insight as to the fact that you would be waking up with that tube in your nose?
Oh, no, no, no. I was so naive. Like, I don't know what I was thinking, but I was not expecting to have all these attachments.
I don't know if that's I don't know if that's naive, Susanna. I think that's not briefed by your medical team.
I was like, I'm a terrible patient. I didn't know what was happening. And you think I would. Like, I've worked in hospitals as a physio, but man, yeah. And then the other surprise was I woke up with my 4 incisions. So I had sort of thought in the back of my mind that might happen. But then after chatting to the team that was actually operating, not Bob, they said, no, like, no way, you're not going to have the big surgery. And anyway, I woke up, sure enough, with the bigger surgery. We went from removing a precancerous polyp, being lucky, to like a bit of a mess. Like,
a lot of a mess from the sound of it.
Yeah. So that was just really confusing at the time. You know, I was so dehydrated, like a basic thing. You'd think, oh, she's nil by mouth, which means all of her fluid demands need to be from this drip. Like the IV is the only way she's getting fluid. Or, oh, she's got a fever, like she's sweating profusely every day. Like she's losing more fluid than we're giving her per hour. So, that just led to complications like, firstly, little things like my lips were bleeding. I had no saliva. I was struggling to talk because I had no saliva. It went from that to like, well, everything sort of deteriorated really fast. And that night, my husband left at about 11 o'clock. So he stayed really late with me every day because the nurses were not coming in, at all to check. Seriously, they were coming maybe once every 5 to 6 hours to check on me. So that night was literally the worst night of my life. When I turned for the worst again, I called him at about 11:30. Like he'd just gotten home. I said, like, you need to come. Like I'm losing my ability to speak. I feel so bad. Like my fever's going up. I can't concentrate. I'm about to pass out. Like I feel like I'm fading away. Like I seriously think I'm going to die. I never thought I'd feel that feeling for a long time, but I felt it that night. So he raced over. And he came to the hospital and thank God we were lucky. Bob just happened to be floating around on the ward for other clients. And I was calling the nurse button for hours, like nurse, nurse, nurse. And no one was coming that whole lead up. Anyway, so my husband got there before the nurse got to me, but he grabbed Bob and he said, Bob, like, look, she's saying she's deteriorating. Like she can feel herself like going, like she can't even keep her eyes open. Yeah. Like her fever's going, no one's come around. No one knows what's like, can tell her what's going on. And she's been sick with the exact same symptoms as ED for 3 days and no one's changing anything with the care.
Yeah.
So Bob raced in because Bob, again, knew my history a little bit from ED, thank God. So he just did 3 different types of antibiotics he started hitting me with. And then he said, like, we need to get you to CT like right now. Like you could be leaking from your operation site. And I thought, what? Like, you've got to be kidding. Like, what do you mean I could be leaking? And what does that mean? Like, if I leak from my op site, what does it mean? He's like, well, I'll be prepping you in the next couple of hours for your 3rd surgery. And I was just like, but no, Bob, this wasn't a part of the deal either. Like, this isn't what anyone said would happen. So then I thought, oh, am I being like over the top? Like, is the pain, like, am I just soft? Like, am I just feeling pain really bad? But no, the CT scan showed peritonitis. Peritonitis is like an abdominal cavity infection. So I had infection in my bowel and then I had infection through my entire abdominal cavity. So then it went full emergency stations again and Bob's just upped all the bags of IV and he said, if your fever and your heart rate isn't reducing after about 3 to 4 hours, first thing in the morning when the doctors come and do their rounds, he's like, we're still going to put you under because you're going to have a clean out. So they'll just basically wash everything around your organs and your intestines, wash out the germs basically. So I was thinking, you're telling me you have to cut straight back through that middle cut? Like, no, no. So anyway, I was freaking out. The other thing that freaked me out was like, oh God, like who's going to be good operating at 6 o'clock in the morning? I was like, there's going to be a random person. Like, I don't know who they are. They don't know who I am. And I don't know who functions good at 6 a.m.
That is not like, the shift for the premium surgeon.
Bob, I don't know if you're busy, but I'm going to need you to get some coffee, right? Yeah.
Exactly. I was like, unless The Rock is doing the surgery, I think he's the only person that functions at like 4 a.m. But like, I did not want a difference. Like, anyway, so that was just another round of stress and anxiety.
Yeah.
On top of everything. And then the other thing that really upset me, and I didn't sleep barely any night I was there, not just because I needed medication every 20 minutes, but I just had no trust. The nurses actually missed a whole type of antibiotic. Mm. I was paying attention to what they were giving me because I was zero trust at this point as well. They called out the name. So before they give you a new drug or something, they ask me my name and date of birth.
Yep.
And then they call out to the other nurse who was in the room as well what they were actually giving me.
Yep.
So I could take note of exactly what I was getting. Anyway, I heard Bob say the three types that I needed, and they did two types. They gave me three loads, but they doubled up on one of the types of antibiotic. And I was like, oh, you didn't give me the gentamicin. They're like, yes, we did. I'm like, nah, like, you didn't call it out. I heard. They're like, yeah, we did. This is, again, 3 o'clock in the morning. Like, I don't know how anyone functions at 3 a.m. But yeah, they missed an antibiotic. So Bob comes in and he's like, nope, you've missed the gentamicin. So I was like, well, again, this is the difference between if I don't clear this infection, yep, hitting it with a broad spectrum of antibiotics, I go to surgery 3 again. Like, yep, you know, all roads lead to shitsville, really.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So you
were clearly functioning at 3 a.m. So I'm going to be calling, the next time I'm in hospital, I'm phoning you, Suzanne.
Near-death experience, man. Oh, I was like, I'm going to die. So if I don't pay attention, I'm going to die.
This is crazy.
Anyway, I was just freaking out. So I was paying attention, but it caught up to me not sleeping for 8 days. Oh, I was a mess afterwards. Yeah. But anyway, they started the antibiotics. Something good finally happened, and he said, nah, you've improved enough that we don't need to do the surgery first thing in the morning to wash you out, unless you take a bad turn again.
Yeah.
So they kept the antibiotics going for another 4 days, I think. Like, I'm talking about, like, probably 20 to 50 bags a day, which then I developed thrush as well. And then I had all these other problems from all the antibiotics. Again, the doctor didn't pick that up. Someone actually came and checked, and they go, nah, you're all good. And then it got worse. And then another doctor came, like, oh yes, we need to give you cream for that.
Yeah.
So just like little things again, it's like, how many times do I need to flag? Like, there's an issue, like, you're not listening to me. And then again, I got to like day 4 or 5, and again, the care was still really poor. Not just the nurse's fault. I know how understaffed they were because I was asking them what their patient ratio was.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I never had a nurse respond to the buzzer within like an hour ever. They never came. So I, again, the amount of times I toileted in the bed and just sat in it, which was traumatizing because for me, I was like, oh no, like I'm super contagious and I've got all these bugs. Like, I don't want to sit in it. And then the next problem, which I didn't think of at all at the time, was that no one had offered me a shower and no one had offered me a bed bath. So we were literally up to day 6 by this stage, and I hadn't brushed my teeth or had any form of hygiene for almost a week.
I just cannot fathom that. I just can't believe that. Like, as someone who's been in a hospital bed, right, and you see them come in with the bed bath stuff and you're like, oh, I don't want to have a bed. No, we'll be having a bed bath. Oh, great, you know. But to
exactly. And that was the thing. Like, I didn't think about it because I was so worried about avoiding a third procedure. I was so worried. I was like, let's get the temperature down. Let's get the heart rate down.
Yeah.
Let's like get your deep breaths happening because I was quite short of breath, which is totally normal. I understand. But I couldn't get out of bed because I was so, like, I felt so sick. I could not even sit over the edge of the bed. The other thing that really sort of helped along the way was not just my husband helping, but my mother-in-law was an ICU nurse for nearly 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
So on about day 3, when I was still declining, she actually came down from the coast. She came down to Canberra and she actually started doing things. Like, she told, there was all the junior doctors were on basically at the time. And I was told by one of the nurses or a doctor, I can't remember who told me, but they said it's common for the junior doctors to be on shift or be brand new at the ward that they're on in February mm-hmm. and March, which mm-hmm. was when I was in there. It's like the either changeover of rotation or they've just started in the hospital. So apparently February in New South Wales, at least, is like the time where you get a big shift of people. So potentially that contributed as well to the sort of lack of care or inaction that happened along the way, whether the junior doctors were worried about making a mistake or worried about going over a more senior doctor's head, changing my, changing my fluids from 63 mils. Like that's what they put me on straight after surgery, day zero.
Yeah.
The fact that you couldn't clinically think that when my situation changed that the, instructions needed to change, like mm-hmm. I'm not sure why there's such a gap, with care there. And then the last thing that really upset me was every morning they do a handover, the doctors or the nurses, to each other at about 6:30. It was in Canberra. And every morning they'd come in, "Hi, Susanna." Sometimes I hadn't even met the nurse for the whole shift, like because they didn't come.
Yeah.
Or someone else was coming and doing the quick obs for them, even though they were my designated nurse.
Yeah.
Or the doctor who was explaining what happened explained it wrong. They were like, "She's had an appendectomy." And I was like, well, I had a bowel resection with major complications and peritonitis, and I've got colitis, and I also had salmonella at the time. And like, there was just all these like problems with the communication between themselves. And then I made friends with one of the nurses. Friends as in, I was just asking her about her family and things.
Friends as in, just someone was talking to you. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. She came in when she was on shift once or twice when I had her, like I talked to her. I sort of made friends with her loosely and we were talking and she goes, "So like, what's your story? Like, what are you actually in here for?" And I was like, "Oh, like, don't you know why I'm here?" She goes, "Nah, like, you looked real bad, but we don't know what happened." And I was like, "Oh, why don't you know what happened?" She goes, "Your file was so long. We didn't have time to read it." And I was like, "Oh, it's long because it is a bit complicated. Like, I had another surgery and, this happened and all these tests came back with infection." Like, it was, I gather the file would be long because there's a lot to tell, but the nurses hadn't even read it.
Probably the fact that it is long is, I mean, I'm no expert, but maybe a good reason to read it.
Yep, would have thought so.
Yeah, like, again, I don't think, like, I can't blame the nurses. Like, I feel guilty. Like, they're amazing. Yeah. They're underpaid. They're undervalued.
Overworked.
But, man, like, it's dangerous for them too, as well as me, obviously. Like, if you don't know what you're dealing with, how do you know what to look out for? I'm certain, like, I could have died. Like, peritonitis alone can kill you. And if I didn't kick and scream and if I didn't listen to myself and, get cranky in the middle sort of part of my stay, like, I wouldn't have got any attention. Like, the nurses were oblivious to it because they didn't ask me what was going on. They weren't there to see. I looked like crap. Like, you could see it in everything. Like, I looked sick. I lost 7 kilos. I was still nil by mouth for 8 days. I was still not cleared to eat or drink for 8 full days. And that was, again, because nobody advised on when I could eat or drink.
Yeah.
It was, again, just a comedy of errors.
I'm laughing.
I can't stop laughing.
Yeah. Woohoo, what a comedy.
It was a disaster.
Looping back to, have you now met the surgeons who were involved in undertaking the second surgery and all the complications that came with that? Have you had the opportunity to actually meet the surgeon, understand it, debrief it, get some closure to it?
Nope. I would have loved to have a chat. Like, were you happy with your incision? Were you happy with it's called an anastomosis when you put the two ends back together.
Mm-hmm.
Like, were you happy with that? Like, did my bowel look healthy? Was there much scar tissue from the first op? Like, all of these things have implications for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
partially my fault. Like, you should always investigate these things as a patient. But yeah, I thought but I did. He was my third point of contact.
I agree with that one.
Like, you know, I'm all about partnership in healthcare, right? Like, yeah, sure, we have to be, you know, informed patients, but in that scenario, the people with the power and the capacity to inform us are the professionals who've got, you know, the qualification. And I think that, you know, I'm such a fan of yours, Susanna, and I just love how pragmatic you are about this. But I think so much of this comes from your experience in healthcare, right? You know so much already. So then you think of yourself as naive for not knowing more. But the majority of patients out there do not have your knowledge. And so of course they're not going to know. And that's, you know, they're waiting to be informed and they weren't. And you were waiting to be informed as well and you weren't. Based on your experience of the health system, and this is the last question that we ask our patient guests, there's a lot of complexity in terms of potential answers for you. But based on your experience of the health system, can you pinpoint for us something that you think is working, something that's broken, and something that the entire system needs to hear right now?
Absolutely. It took me a while to think of something. I was sitting there like, oh God, what is working from my experience? But there was a guy, he's a CNC, which is a clinical nurse consultant. So that's just like a more advanced position for a nurse. Mm-hmm. He was a godsend. Like, I would say he's the thing that is working in the system. So the power of one person is insane. I had not had a good experience with any nursing staff, any doctor, any junior doctor, nobody, no experience. But this guy, he had to come in because they couldn't hit a cannula again because they didn't give me water. So he had to go through my bicep, like to do a larger gauge cannula so they could give me more antibiotics quicker. That was on the night that it all went to hell on day three. Mm-hmm. So I was freaking out, and he came over and he was the gentlest, most caring, brilliant person I have ever met in the health system. He came over and he just said, hey, look, like, I'm sorry you're going through such a horrible time. This needle is much bigger than what you've had, but it'll be able to deliver you more of the antibiotics so you can feel better faster. Yep. He said, I'm going to try my best to make it not hurt. And he's like, I've got some gel and I've got an ice cube. He's like, I'm going to numb the area and then I'm going to put it in. Little did I know, while he's holding the ice cube, he'd already put it in. And then he's like, okay, you're all done, Susanna. And I was like, what? Like, that took 30 seconds. You were nice. You told me what was happening and why, which instantly settled me down. Like, I was relaxed for those 30 seconds because he told me what he was doing and why. And the fact that I could get more medicine into me quicker to hit this infection, like, instantly as well. Oh, thank God. Like, I need all of these cannulas in my bicep then. Yeah. So he's the thing that's working. Like, the one person, it takes one person in the whole system in health and it will change your whole experience. So, I'd say health has that going for it. One person can make all the difference.
Wow. That's super, super insightful. And I hope a lot of people are hearing you on that.
The thing that I think is broken, I know Adam touched on communication and I absolutely agree. That was the first thing that came to mind. But in regards to communication, like the education from the doctors with the client, with the patient is just, in my case, it was non-existent except for Bob, who was dealing with me the most or who was my treating surgeon or anything. It just happened that he answered my question. So I really think we need to work on educating patients, educating them on what's happening to them because it's happening to them. Yeah. So many people I talk to as well on top of myself is they don't walk away from hospital or while they're there, they don't understand what's happening to them. And I just think that's so wrong because you're supposed to get informed consent and they seriously have no idea what's going on. So that is broken. Something I'd love the whole system to hear is ask questions. Mm. Like, you will not find an answer if you don't ask a question. Yeah. Like, if someone is deteriorating, like, there are signs, there are symptoms, there are red flags. As a physio, I even learn these things to identify in a client. So I know the medical training would be the same. So I just feel like, please ask questions. please listen to the answers and please fall back on your medical training. Like, whilst I saw junior doctors, you know, I'm assuming they were too scared to change protocols from the senior doctor because they didn't do anything.
Yeah.
I was screaming and kicking and screaming and telling them what I thought and what made me feel sick, but they didn't listen and they didn't change anything. So, you know, why do you go to uni and why do you get trained to, you know, to think clinically if you're not going to apply your knowledge? Mm-hmm. Like I just feel like there needs to be a safe space for younger doctors and all doctors in general to be able to actually, you know, ask questions of their seniors or ask questions of the team around them without feeling inferior or inadequate. So then they can actually action something, because with me, I had an NG tube, as I said, and that didn't get removed for 8 days. Which meant I couldn't eat for 8 days. So that could have been taken out a few days earlier, as the treating surgeon, his team who came in on the last day said. Do you know, that inaction and not thinking clinically, like, that led to other consequences that were harmful to me. So inaction can be just as bad as wrong action.
Mm. Oh, wow. So insightful. I just wish that the insights that you have into this system didn't come from such a traumatic and horrendous experience for you, Susanna. But I'm so grateful you shared it with us.
Thank you so much for having me. You guys are legends. I've taken up a lot of time chatting with you today, so thank you for being so patient. And you guys are like super inspirational in your own right. And I follow you guys. So thank you for giving me the feeling of empowerment that I can speak and that my own experience is legitimate and I don't have to be ashamed or compare it, and it's not a competition and who's sicker or who's had a crappier time. Like, it's not about that. It's just about sharing an experience so everyone can benefit. So thank you so much.
And in the spirit of shared experiences, Susanna, thank you so much for your vulnerability and your bravery and your experience.
Yeah. Hear, hear.
Do you know the thing I think I found most depressing? I don't know why we're measuring that, but here we are. about that story is, I mean, there's a lot to unpack, but Susanna's telling us the thing that she thinks is working in the medical system is quite literally a dude just doing his job.
Yeah.
That to me is a real obvious measure of a system that maybe is not working as perhaps it was intended.
Yes.
And on that point, the impact that a single person can have on any patient in any healthcare system, as Susanna rightly says, is profound. And that I've experienced that. I think you've experienced that.
Definitely.
I'm sure there's countless patients that have also. So that that point hits hard for me.
I could not agree more. And, you know, building on that, I think her statement about inaction is just as bad as wrong action is a statement in support of that point of view also, because I feel like, you know, there are many opportunities for us to do better at what we do, and not doing that and just staying in our lane, kind of being inactive and not chasing improvement, is just pretty much going to yield the same results, really. So if we're looking for change, if we're looking for progress, if we're looking for improvement, we need to make that part of our everyday.
Segway is the name of that contrary two-wheeled contraption.
Oh, yeah. That's a good point.
That some people ride around on. Mm-hmm. I wonder if our next guest has one.
I don't think we got a chance to ask him.
We should have.
Look,
it felt to us like the most appropriate sort of professional to speak to, having heard Susanna's experience, was a colorectal surgeon.
Yeah, and I, incidentally, funnily enough, I knew one.
Cut to.
Please, you know, casually introduce via a little soundbite of our infamous theme song.
I shall.
Phil Smart, colorectal surgeon. And he is the man, the only man, who has stuck a camera both up the bottom of myself and Sean. So that's his claim to fame. And Phil Smart, if you would like to offer any further introduction to yourself, we welcome you now.
I think it is very important for the audience that we address this very specific point. I would say, you know, try and imagine the meal you had 15 meals ago and what it was like. Mm-hmm. And I had a very clever mentor who told me one day, he said, after 30,000 bottoms, they all look the same. So even if you tried to remember what someone's specific bottom even looked like, it's not going to happen. So
well, that's disappointing mostly.
Unfortunately, we're all the same.
Thank you for the clarification. And thank you for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Pleasure.
Now, you've had the opportunity to listen to Susanna's story, obviously, and we are just so fortunate that a patient who has been through quite a, you know, traumatic experience has taken the time to share it with us and you know, acknowledge the fact that doing so has given her just an opportunity to kind of get some closure to an experience that for her was, you know, a lot. And I think that we could agree that upon listening to it, that it was a lot. And I guess in welcoming you to the podcast today, what we're trying to achieve is obviously not to address Susanna's specific issues, which she quite rightly pointed out were, you know, hers to own and to process and to work through. But I think what we have learned from Susanna's sharing is that there are some fundamental issues with communication issues that have already been raised on this podcast by other patients. And more broadly, I think system-based issues that we could probably just get some insight from you in terms of what it's like to be on the other side of the system. And that's our thinking in welcoming you here today. So I just wondered whether you just could give us some high-level takes on your interpretation of Susanna's story and other sort of equivalent complication-based stories in terms of what happens in our health system when we just try to do the things that you're doing every day.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, we were talking briefly before this about, you know, I can deeply empathise with the story because, you know, I think literally in the middle of me listening to that interview, I was on the phone with not a directly analogous situation, but something very similar to have a patient in another hospital that I'm looking after. There's lots going on and lots of discussion back and forth about communication, and I was kind of reflecting on it because I'm like, I am that story right now. And you know, I think I would say two things that you know, there's no question that experience at a patient level is horrendously traumatic. I mean, I think I can, you know, sort of you wonder sometimes about the kind of fortitude of people when they're in that sort of situation, and COVID has really compounded that to a much higher level because, you know, we have this experience that's unprecedented where patients' families are barred from the hospital. So right in the middle of going through that experience where, you know, I think we definitely rely on families and then it's sort of doubled down because you've got a patient who has had an unexpected outcome. There's obviously a lot of uncertainty in that context. And I think that is a very challenging situation. And, you know, I think communication, you know, is the foundation of a lot of medical school kind of teaching, but yet day to day and, you know, really in the trenches and things like that, there are, you know, where, particularly where there are so many different strains and different directions, you know, unfortunately is one of those things that gets lost because, you know, maybe it's not valued as much as we all think it should be. And so, you know, maybe we can talk about some of those other pressures and things like that. But, I mean, I think initially I think it's just an acknowledgement that, first of all, clinicians, you know, to a level that we don't ignore, you learn so much from your patients. I think some of the best medical care I've learned is from listening to patients either solve their own problems or they talk to other patients or they find other doctors. And, you know, it's definitely a two-way conversation. And I think one of the things that's important is, you know, I was listening to that story and you can kind of, for me, it's very easy to visualize everyone in that story. And you know, I've been kind of, at some point in the 20 odd years, I've been sort of hanging around the hospitals and stuff in that position, whether it's the orderly, the night nurse, the emergency physician, the intern, the super subspecialist who's in another state operating on a patient from another state. And, you know, I did that last week and it is not an enjoyable situation for a lot of people because of all those communication pressures. Mm. You know, I think the first acknowledgement is that, you know, these are very good conversations for everyone to have. I think that everyone benefits. So, I mean, I would congratulate Zana on the clarity of her story, you know.
Absolutely. And I think that's something that came through for Sean and I again and again in talking to her was absolutely her vulnerability and her just frankness and openness in sharing. Something that also comes across in Susanna's conversation with us is her health literacy and the fact that she is a physiotherapist and the fact that she understands the Australian health system and the fact that she could ask questions and seek information and make assessments on clinical decisions as they were being made. And I'm interested in your take and your experience on what a difference health literacy makes in terms of the care outcomes, I guess, that patients can achieve.
Well, again, it may not kind of age well, but I mean, COVID has really accelerated a lot of this or just made it much more magnified because, you know, you have this huge extra layer of bureaucracy and that you can see day to day that patients who are health literate with respect to how the system operates achieve a much better outcome, and that is regardless of the system that they're in, whether it's public or private, or the kind of care and all that kind of thing. So, I mean, I think it is a major driver of health outcome. You know, I often say to patients, you know, what is the difference between what I can say and what you can get from the internet, where you really have access to literally the world's information on your particular condition.
Yeah.
And, you know, what the clinician day-to-day experiences provide is exactly that kind of guidance where you see you are able to navigate whatever operational issue it is that's a barrier to the optimal care. And, you know, often it's this sliding scale between how much do you allocate resources to communications like long consultations, things like that,
yes,
versus the volume of procedures that you're doing. And then, you know, these are tricky decisions because would it be better to go to the world's best polyp removal person who you never get to talk to because they're doing 50 a day versus the person who does it once on a Friday afternoon and will talk to you five times, you know? I you know, it's one of those things where there's no absolutely right answer and clearly there's a middle ground. I think if you are a patient with a little bit of a tricky dilemma like that, then you know, that's that is a scenario where you see that communication is you know, even more important than some of the other scenarios. The other elephant in the room is that sometimes the best technicians are not the best communicators, oddly. And, you know, and I think it probably, as particularly as procedural specialists, every bit of scientific data that gets measured is surfaces the idea that volume improves outcome. So we did a little bit of work on this front is that, let's say, for example, you've broken your ankle and you're looking for an ankle specialist and you're wondering, and you know, who should you go and see? And at the moment you either ask your GP, you ask your neighbor, you Google a big fancy hospital. It's not particularly scientific on the basis. You might go on what the photo looks like on the website or rate your MD review or something like that. But really, probably the only bit of information you need is the volume of surgery that person does in a year. Because you can be agnostic about the reason, but if that person is doing volume specialties, the system will self-correct if they don't get good outcomes and that person won't be doing it anymore.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think it is an incredibly odd thing from my perspective that the payers, that's the patients themselves who do fund healthcare either directly or indirectly, the government, who are in Australia are the majority funder in both public and private for healthcare, and then also the insurance companies, where they don't get much more granular and kind of blowtorch on where and who is producing the best outcomes.
But if we kind of take a step back to your comment about, you know, the most powerful piece of information here potentially just being the volume of work that's been done in a particular area, does the patient, do Australian patients currently have access to that information?
No, not. And, you know, I think, you know, broadly and philosophically, should data be surfaced? Hell yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the US is generally sort of 10 years ahead of us, and, you know, at a government level, I think there is lots of good that could be done with opening up data. And that, well, you know, you just start with the anonymized big data sources and you let people play around with them, and the federal government and various governments have definitely done that. So you could go, for example, and you look at a particular procedure as measured by the Medicare schedule, and you can find the volume data on how often that is done. It's not going to be available at a hospital level, but, you know, it probably should be.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, we as health, you know, on the patient side, it would be very nice to have that access to that information. And it does need to be filtered, because data can be gamed and, you know, high-risk patients can be denied care and stuff like that. So it has to be very carefully curated. But I think it really should be surfaced, and maybe the avenue is through My Health Record or something like that. But, I think at an individual level, health data, I think, you know, we know that the more involved patients are and they ask questions and they self-correct and they edit their own, you know, address and all the other details in there, all the other minor things at an administrative level, and even at a clinical level, that makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
I think that's definitely well known. And I get a very common scenario where people come in and say, oh, I'm sorry, doctor, but I've just spent time on Dr. Google, and I'm going, mm-hmm. No, that's a very good thing that you were interested in the outcome of your care and you can ask all the questions. You know, we want to bring all those to the surface.
If, I don't know if this is a question so much as it's a statement, but if we're willing to acknowledge that a patient's degree of medical literacy will have an impact on their outcome, like it seems, I don't know if I'm just not understanding, but I'm kind of astonished that we're willing to define that in any way as a success. Like that's, if we leave room for a patient not to speak up and therefore not have the outcome, like that's not successful in my mind.
That's right. And I think it's successful, you know, depends on what vantage point you're looking from. And, you know, I think Nicole and I, we had this situation come up in another context in a meeting about like, who is measuring success? Is it the system or is it the patient? And that, you know, ideally they would be aligned. You know, a good patient outcome is a good outcome from the system's point of view. And that a lot of the time, you know, it goes hand in hand, but not always. So, I think in a space like clinical outcomes registries where diseases are measured in a systematic way, like hip replacements or, you know, vascular implants or breast reconstruction and other things where they measure a range of technical outcomes, it's often surprising to me to understand that a lot of them at the moment don't measure or report anything that the patient values. Like there's just no measurement. Did you know you can cure the cancer, but did the patient benefit from that treatment? And you know, it's surprisingly poorly measured. And you know, I think there are health services and hospitals, you know, mainly overseas, that have done much more detailed work on patient experience, because a lot of it, the system is geared not necessarily to individual patients primarily. It might either be geared in a private hospital context, it may be geared to the clinician who brings the work to that hospital, and in the public hospitals, it may be geared optimally to the waiting list or the administrative side, not the individual patient experience. Because you think what power does an individual patient have? The health service doesn't go bankrupt because the patient has a bad experience at public hospital, you know, and similarly in the private sector, the hospital doesn't go bankrupt as long as the specialist keeps bringing their work there. And so I think those drivers of quality, I think that you know, they need to be much better defined, where, for example, could you as a patient look at a health service and get their you know, published quality of care reports as measured and reported by patients at a systematic level? That's not gamed. It's not a Google review that, you know, has been astroturfed or whatever. It's a proper, transparent review of the patient experience within that health service. And then, you know, ideally then they can self-correct and address some of those deficiencies.
So what I love about this conversation and about what you're sharing right now is just the blunt acknowledgement that not every player in the system measures success the same way. Because what is enormously frustrating as a patient advocate is to sit down and have conversations with various system players and for them all to purport to be championing patient outcomes and patient experience, of course, as the number one thing and the most important thing that we have to measure and we have to champion all the time. And if we could stop saying that and we could start saying, well, no, because, you know, some of these entities are commercial entities and they have to make money, and some of these entities are government entities and they've got to fund more than one thing, not just a health system, you know. And I think if we actually had more honest conversations with the influences, the power influences, the dynamics at work, then we could start to arrive at better collaborative decision making and better ultimate acknowledgement and championing of a patient's place within that dynamic.
Well, I think you're exactly right, and I think that is a late understanding from my perspective, is that when you look at a service and a problem and a committee and a decision maker and things like that, the first thing, you know, to understand is what are they trying to optimize for?
Yeah.
And it might be for an academic outcome. It might be for a commercial outcome. It might be for, you know, but it is not necessarily for a patient experience outcome.
No.
And, that may or may not be correct according to the person who's asking the question. But, you know, as we've talked about, I think that the key phrase, even though it sort of sounds like a cliche, it's definitely a matter of health literacy. You know, the first step is just sort of defining, okay, what is the current system that we've created, and how do you navigate through it, and what are the compromises that have been made? To, you know, and we are extremely lucky, we have got overall a fairly equitable system that does perform well on all of the standards that it seems to be measured by. But can it do better? Hell yeah. I mean, and I think the missing ingredient is definitely evening out the the probably historic kind of differences between the system itself and the people it's trying to kind of serve. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think the simple things as an individual patient, it's definitely about doing your research, getting your making sure that you can work out how to get the conversation with the specialist you want to ask the questions for, you know, where to get, you know, access to your own health information. I mean, that's, as a specialist, that's one of the most common day-to-day tasks we do, is just, you know, you need a PhD in cracking into health systems to get information out, whether it's just a simple blood test that was done 6 months ago that no one can access. Yeah. And then some patients walk in with a folder and it's all there. It's definitely a two-way conversation in its optimal sort of format.
It is, but I feel like health literacy is enabled by health system honesty and accountability. And I think that until we have that piece to sort of say, you know, for the system itself, again, to acknowledge that, you know, its path to digital is quite broken at the moment. And, you know, it's very difficult to achieve. You know, you can't, and if you're having trouble and yourself and your administrative team who navigate this system every day, well, then what possible hope has a patient got to empower themselves within the system, to seek the information that is actually their own, to navigate, you know, these government websites and download their files or private path sites or what have you?
Your local hospital will almost, you know, you have to do an FOI request to get your own record and, you know, you have a blood test and you're the last to know what the result is.
Totally.
I mean, it's absurd. And I think, you know, specifically to colorectal cancer and specifically to our local context, which is Victoria, I mean, as of today, it's surprising how simple changes can have a huge, you know, would potentially have a huge impact. And one of the things, for example, that is just, it would cost about $1.50 to implement, is a publicly available colonoscopy waiting list. Mm-hmm. So as it stands today, if you go to a health service and you need a colonoscopy and I request that colonoscopy, there is literally no way I can find out how many people are there ahead of you, what the time frame is, and how it's categorized. It just doesn't exist. And why does that not exist when, you know, it's available for your cataract, it's available for your heart bypass, but it's not available for your colonoscopy? Mm. So, you know, as a health, if I was, you know, an alien from space and I needed a colonoscopy and I came to Victoria, I'd be like, well, why can't you even tell me how long it's going to take?
Yeah, amazing. That's nuts, really. If I ask you, as a very experienced surgeon and navigator of our system and of our realities, and then also, you know, as I have experienced, quite a vocal advocate of patients and their needs, if I asked you personally for the, you know, the one thing that we could be doing or should be doing, is it the colonoscopy waiting list, or, you know, at a system level, what, you know, what is the simple thing that would make a difference? And I think I'm thinking particularly about the communication problem, because it's been raised so consistently in our sort of 2 out of 2 guests so far on the Inpatient Podcast, and more broadly in the community by patients every day.
I mean, kind of as you're talking there, I'm scanning through the list of 25 things that I would love to implement. I think, you know, it's the single most important thing is transparency. It just, if you just know what the playing field is and, you know, why it's like that, and then, you know, I think that's definitely the huge difference, that the system can easily, in ways that we have with technology and email and all that kind of stuff, you know, you still, if you, simple things like if you're putting a patient on a waiting list, they still post to the form generally. And so we, you know, I think as an individual specialist working across both the public and private sector, and I am just, you know, a regular suburban colorectal surgeon, it really is assistance with sort of raising the level of transparency of the structure of the system and how to navigate it. And maybe, you know, like, I think there are very significant questions in both the public and private sector where that can be done better, much more easily. You know, costs, waiting lists, access, workflows, why is it like this? You know, I think once people get an understanding of the rationale behind the way that the decisions are made, it just takes out a lot of the anxiety and the stress.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, I think there are many instances where in Susanna's story where the technical outcome, you know, would still pass governance through the health systems. You know, that proceduralist has a perforation, the perforation is corrected, as long as that's not happening every single time and with the acceptable complication rates, that, you know, that's still modern 2022 best practice care, that kind of thing. And, you know, it is helpful, useful that the gastroenterologist did not ignore symptoms and made a diagnosis and did the colonoscopy and all that kind of stuff. So there are lots of things where that care episode from some aspects and vantage points of the health system that was successful, but there are clearly some very easy and often, you know, not particularly expensive ways where a hell of a lot of anxiety and kind of suffering and trauma and can be sort of avoided by, you know, some change within the system. You know, I would love to say that even in my own clinical practice, I think every single day you face a mistake in communication where it could have been done better. So it's not an easy task, but it's definitely sort of undervalued, I think.
We are really grateful for your participation, Phil, but and I think that we could all agree that we couldn't have more admiration and greater thanks for Susanna and her, again, just her sharing of her story, her her vulnerability, and you know, and just acknowledging her, you know, her intent. And I really relate to this sort of advocacy streak that she's had an experience and she wants to share it for the purposes of improvement and for the hope that other people don't go through that same thing. And the more that we do that, you know, of course, the better. Ultimately, as long as people are listening, the better the outcome. If people are willing to change, but it always comes with a burden, and patients will know that and understand that you know there is always a burden in sharing your experience, and that's a decision that you make when you decide to do it. But I think she's done a wonderful thing in kicking off this conversation, which has just been so enlightening and has just been transparent and real. So thank you, Phil, for that and for your participation.
Yeah, that's. Thank you. And thank you to Suzanne. I mean, if you look just on my individual day, I think I probably called my patient earlier than I would have in the middle of a podcast because I was, you know, I was struck by, so, you know, these conversations with the clinicians, we really value that kind of clarity of description in that experience. And, you know, hopefully we can avoid that kind of negative experience in the future.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I'm sure it would mean so much to Susanna to hear that. So thank you for saying so. Amazing. Thanks.
So I don't know why I'm making this a competition with myself to find the thing that depresses me most about stories that people tell us, but here we are.
Go on then.
The thing that depresses me most about Phil's story is that health literacy affects the outcome of a patient. To me, that is so monumentally unfair.
Yes. Yeah. Completely agree. I think that there are many complex reasons why health literacy is a problem, right? There are many contributing factors to why, you know, not every patient is equal in just waking up and being able to know everything they need to know about their own health and their, you know, experience of the system, navigating the system, you know. That gap exists for many reasons, and I think really points to the fact that given its impact on outcomes for patients, we should probably have an expert on the show who talks about health literacy. And when Phil says something like every piece of scientific data that gets measured points to the fact that volume improves outcome, that's probably a pretty important piece of information for a patient just to know of and be aware of, but then B, take action on, right? A patient needs to be able to then be in a position to take action on that piece of measured data.
It's the key word.
Measured is important.
Because we're not measuring the stuff that is necessarily important to the patient.
No, we're not. Overwhelmingly, we're not.
And so your definition of success is entirely different to a patient's definition of success.
That's right. And Phil summed that up when he said, you know, success depends on the vantage point. Where are you measuring from? Are you measuring for the patient or are you measuring for the system? Mm. And of course, the answer at the moment is we're measuring for the system and we only measure for the system. That's the only measurement that exists. And we know that overseas, because we can, you know, compare ourselves to things that happen in other jurisdictions across the world, and we know that things like patient-reported outcomes measures, patient-reported experience measures are captured by international jurisdictions in a much more formalised way than they are done here. But I think a lot of Australians who haven't really experienced anything particularly acute or chronic within their own health system, I think Australians would be very surprised to hear that the system really has very little interest in a patient's individual experience of their care or a patient's individual view on the outcome of their care. The system is not concerned with that.
And with that.
And with that, it's a wrap.
It's a wrap.
Now, can I just say a big thank you to Susanna?
The biggest of thank yous.
I don't think we could thank her enough.
No.
What champion.
And I don't know how to say this bit.
Give it a go, though.
No, I don't think I'm going to leave people guessing.
Okay.
I wonder what he was going to say. Sounded like it might have been profound, but
great
no.
Podcast.
Joke's on you.
Can we thank Phil also?
We should. Thank you so much, Phil.
Thanks, Phil. What a first medical professional to join us. Hope it's the start of the flood of medical professionals who will be contacting the Inpatient Podcast and saying, can I assist you guys? Can I join you at the table?
Tell your friends.
Tell your friends, yeah. Rate and share and give us some feedback.
Nicole, as is tradition, is about to bust into her best rendition of...
Beyonce?
Well,
It was J-Lo. I was going to move to Beyonce this for episode 2, but let's not. Let's wrap it.
Please.